HIV/AIDS has reached every corner of the globe over the past three decades. Today we conclude our five-part series, AIDS Then and Now, with a look at how the virus has transformed lives around the world. And joining us now is Dr. Gottfried Hernschall, Director of the HIV Program for the World Health Organization. Welcome to our show.
Hello, good afternoon.
How many people around the world are currently infected with HIV?
Well, according to figures from 2008, there's about 33 million people living with HIV. And just in 1 year, in 2008, and we're just now analyzing the figures for 2009, about 2.7 million new infections occurred. And still, within that 1 year, 2 million AIDS-related deaths.
So has the global number of cases continued to rise exponentially, or is it leveled off in certain places?
Well, fortunately, due to a really unprecedented global response, in most parts of the world, or in many parts of the world, we do see a leveling off. And in some instances, the leveling off occurs at unacceptably high levels, for example, in Southern Africa. But the good thing is we do not, in those parts where there was some real worry that this might happen, we didn't see a further exponential increase such as in South Africa. There are, however, parts like Eastern Europe and Central Asia where we continue to see a very worrisome increase, and that obviously requires an exceptional response.
And we'll be looking at all of those places as we continue this conversation. One of the areas we could not cover just because of circumstances beyond our control was China. What's happening in China?
Well, China, like many other countries in Asia, is suffering from a dual epidemic in one way, and that is that the epidemic of injection drug use. And in China, we have seen an increase in injection drug use, and also in HIV transmitted through injection drug use, as well as in sex workers, and also in men who have sex with men populations, MSM populations. We have also seen over the last few years a very strong response by the Chinese government and together with civil society. But still, we need to keep a very close look to see what is really happening in China.
The number of people being treated for HIV/AIDS around the world has increased by something like tenfold between 2002 and 2007. While those drugs have allowed people to live longer, have they slowed the spread of the virus at all?
Well, indeed, the numbers that have finally access to treatment has dramatically increased. And from WHO, we're actually very proud in one way and also happy to see that trend because in sort of, let's say, in 2002, 2003, really treatment was very much reserved for the rich north, let's say, for Europe and Northern America. But now we really see an incredible treatment scale up also in the low and middle income countries. And I think it's about 5 million people who will have access to treatment by the end of this year. Now, what we also see is, and this is just recently getting a lot of attention, is that those people who are effectively on treatment have a much smaller risk of actually spreading the virus. So there is a real prevention benefit for people being on treatment.
With all of these people taking HIV medications, is there concern about whether some strains of the virus will become drug resistant?
Yes, definitely. We do see drug resistance, and WHO does work very closely with a number of governments in very carefully monitoring the emergence of drug resistant strains. That is, of course, a concern. The good part of the story, so to speak, is that we have now a much broader range of medicines available and more options for those who develop drug resistance. However, there is progression from first-line medicines to second-line antiretroviral drugs to third-line antiretroviral drugs. And the problem is that the second- and third-line antiretroviral drugs are much more expensive than the first-line. So there is obviously also a very important cost implication there.
In your opinion, should medical researchers be focusing mostly on new drugs to manage the infection or on a vaccine?
Well, I do think it's one versus the other. Unfortunately, to date, we do not have yet a viable vaccine. And some of the initially quite promising studies have not actually led to the development of a final product. It is important that we do not sort of work one, have one versus the other, and really vaccine research needs to continue, and also further research on medicines, on further antiretroviral drugs also is important to continue. And we obviously will have to work towards finding simpler drug regimens, and this is obviously a conversation that's now taking place among the various research partners, the international organizations, WHO, UNAIDS. We just held actually a meeting on the 9th of June in New York to really initiate this very important dialogue with the various partners, including pharmaceutical industry, to look towards cheaper and simpler drug regimen.
Well, is there one global strategy for fighting AIDS, or do HIV-related policies have to be tailored on a country-by-country basis?
Well, I think one needs both. I think one needs global targets, one needs global direction, one needs global guidelines, and this is what primarily WHO does. In addition to that, obviously, there's so much country-to-country differences that each country by itself needs to develop its own national strategy and its national AIDS response. So one, it's not one versus the other. I think the global strategy will have to inform national plans, and these will vary according to the various circumstances in given countries.
My guest is Dr. Gottfried Hernschall of the World Health Organization. We're talking to him as part of our series, AIDS Then and Now. And you're talking to us from Dubai, where you're attending an AIDS conference. What's happening with infection rates and trends in the Middle East?
Well, as you said, we are at a very interesting conference here. It's focusing on the situation in Middle Eastern countries and North African countries. And what we see in the Middle East is that the epidemics are very heavily concentrated, again, in most at-risk populations, men who have sex with men, drug users, specifically injection drug users, and also sex workers. The challenge in this part of the world, obviously, is that these situations and these risk populations are heavily stigmatized. They sort of submitted to punitive laws, and therefore the transparent response is not easy. It's not very obvious. However, I'm quite encouraged by the reactions and the response and the discussions that we are having with the ministers of health here in Dubai. And I do believe there is sort of increasing openness to really tackle some of those very sensitive issues.
What about the Middle Eastern governments where politics and religion are often combined, like Saudi Arabia? Are they taking the proper steps to combat the virus or even to understand how it's being transmitted in their own population?
Yeah, well, obviously, that's exactly the challenge. And as you say, social norms often influenced by religion in various parts of the world, not only in the Middle East, often constitutes certain barriers to an effective response and to an effective response that is based on public health principles and not on dogma.
What's the situation in Western Europe? When we originally produced this series back in 1987, many of our guests praised the willingness of European public health officials to promote condom use and safe sex practices. Have those policies continued, and have they had a net positive effect?
Definitely, definitely. We have seen in Europe initially, probably, and in the United States, a very important response, and that has led to a very early leveling off of new infections. And what we unfortunately are seeing now is in some countries we're seeing again that some of the high-risk groups, the most at-risk populations, we're seeing an increasing trend in some of those, specifically in men who have sex with men.
Well, we're seeing that in this country as well, where younger people who did not live through the crisis of the 80s and 90s are now engaging in unsafe sex again.
Yes, we definitely see that also in the United States. In addition, we see a very important, unfortunate demographic shift in the United States, where African Americans are really disproportionately affected by the epidemic. For example, you have like something like 12% of the population in the U.S. is African American, but they do account to close to 50% of the HIV prevalence and 45% of new infections only in 2007. So that is really of great concern.
Why is it that the World Health Organization has had remarkable success fighting some infectious diseases like polio and smallpox, but found HIV/AIDS, especially in places like Africa, to be such a difficult target?
Well, the HIV virus, unfortunately, is different than other viruses, and it's a situation where a lot of factors that are very personal, that are very much influenced by social norms and standards, affect the way the virus travels. And I do, however, believe that what has happened with the 3x5 initiative were in 2003, the WHO declared an initiative to bring 3 million people within 2 years on treatment, has been an incredible success, not only in bringing people on treatment, but really on triggering a global conversation to no longer accept these inequities that existed between the North and the South. Just now this year, as we're in 2010, we're looking forward to 2015 and at the Millennium Development Goals. And we are now, together with UNAIDS, trying to really, over the next 5 years, further scale up the response and hopefully overcome the epidemic. And it's the new target is zero new infections, zero discrimination, and zero people on HIV. So this is obviously a very aspirational target, but I think it will require that the UN organizations, together with the governments, together with civil society, and also together with the funding partners, really scale up over the next few years. And I do think further progress is definitely doable and feasible.
I've been talking with Dr. Gottfried Hernschall, director of the HIV program for the World Health Organization. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Southern Africa has long been one of the epicenters of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Joining us now is Dr. Gilles Van Cutsem, a medical coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in South Africa and Lesotho. Thank you for participating in our series, AIDS Then and Now.
It's a pleasure. Good morning to you.
Aren't something like 80% of the over 40 million people infected with HIV around the world located in Africa alone?
Yes, that's definitely true. And the largest proportion of HIV infected is mostly in Southern Africa. So that is Zimbabwe, Malawi, Mozambique, South Africa, Lesotho, Botswana, and Namibia.
So it can't all be blamed on Thabo Mbeki's policies?
No, I wouldn't say that. It happened before Thabo Mbeki. Thabo Mbeki just made it much worse, but the HIV epidemic started long before the dangerous policies of Thabo Mbeki. And also, we have very high prevalence of HIV in all the surrounding countries, not just South Africa.
Well Thabo Mbeki, who used to be the president of South Africa, famously questioned the link between HIV and AIDS. Were his views generally shared by people in the area?
let us say that he had a very large and negative influence on society at large. I mean, it's like the United States. Not everyone agrees with what the president is saying. The same was true in South Africa. But when the president is pushing one line very strongly, as Thabo Mbeki did, it influences the society in general, and especially with a problem like HIV, where stigma is such a big problem. If you have a president who says that antiretroviral therapy is toxic and who questions the link between HIV and AIDS, it causes a lot of damage.
Well, what percentage of the South African population is estimated to be either HIV positive or living with AIDS, and how many of them are receiving medication?
So 12% of the total population, that's 18.6% of the adult population, is infected with HIV in South Africa, and at the moment, about 50%, about half of the ones who need ARVs, antiretroviral treatment, are accessing it. But that is 1 million people who are on treatment. The South African government has recently embarked onto a broad scale scaling up of antiretroviral therapy and aim at covering another million of people in the coming 2 years. And so that means by 2012, we should have 2 million people on ARVs in South Africa, which is the largest antiretroviral treatment program in the world. It already is with 1 million, but with 2 million, it would be even more so. Actually, speaking about Thabo Mbeki, as much as he did give the bad example, the current government is giving the good example in terms of political commitment towards treating patients with HIV, and also financial commitment, which cannot be said of all other resource-limited setting countries, or even of the U.S. government or European governments, which are at the moment either flatlining or decreasing funding for HIV.
I'd imagine that the health sector has had some difficulty absorbing all of these new patients. What kinds of medical facilities do most HIV/AIDS doctors and specialists have available to them there and in other parts of Africa?
Yeah, well, as you know, Africa has a tremendous lack of human resources for health. When in rich countries, you would have one doctor for, you would have 500 doctors for every 100,000 inhabitants. In South Africa, you have 69 doctors for every 100,000. And in poorer countries like Malawi, you have less than one doctor for every 100,000. So we cannot treat HIV with doctors. We've more and more used what you call task shifting or task sharing, where a number of tasks that are traditionally being performed by doctors are being performed by nurses, and a number of tasks that are traditionally being performed by nurses are being shifted towards lay health workers, counselors, treatment supporters. And I must say that it's working very well.
Now, in some parts of the world, transmission is largely sexual. In other parts, it's through intravenous drug abuse. What about in Africa?
In Africa, as you certainly know, it's an heterosexual sexual epidemic. So the large majority of the transmission is through sexual intercourse.
And is it rural or urban or everywhere?
It is everywhere. It probably had initially urban focus, but now it has spread to rural areas. The apartheid strategies of taking away men from rural areas to have them work in mines, and so have very large congregations of men with very often around these congregations, commercial sex workers, has very much contributed to the early spread of the epidemic. But now we are dealing with what you call a generalized epidemic, and it is as much in urban and peri-urban as in rural areas.
In the early days of HIV infection, it was many people said, well, it's mostly a homosexual disease because of the way it's transmitted. How has it become so heterosexual in Africa, which is not the case in most other parts of the world?
Yeah, so there's several theories about that. I definitely don't have the final word on that, but more and more what is thought is that there is much more concurrency of sexual partnerships in Africa culturally, which means you have very often stable relationships at the same time, and as opposed to many other countries where you have more serial relationships, and concurrency definitely makes relational networks overlap and promotes transmission much more. There are many other factors. There's the factor that Africa is the poorest continent, and so just availability of prevention like condoms only arrived much later. The prevention campaigns that were very important in the U.S. and in Europe in the 80s and in the 90s only came much later to Africa, and still there's many places where those are not as available as they are. So it's a complex problem, but concurrency plays a role, poverty plays a role, and I'm sure you will have an epidemiologist talking after me or before me who can give you more information.
Have you found one particular approach has been the most effective in preventing the spread of the virus in Africa?
No, it's definitely not. I don't think we can promote a one magic bullet approach. Prevention is definitely multi-pronged. Treatment is part of prevention. As you know, antiretroviral therapy decreases the viral load, and so treating more people actually is a very effective way of decreasing new infections. Condoms play a very important role. Education and information campaign play a very important role. I think it's not a matter of one magic bullet. It's having several strategies used together, and that is treatment and prevention together.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Dr. Gilles Van Cutsem, Medical Coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in South Africa and Lesotho.
You're welcome.
Up next, we continue our global survey to check in on Central Asia, Southeast Asia, and Brazil. We'll see how they're dealing with the HIV/AIDS pandemic. It's all part of the final segment in our AIDS Then and Now series. Later in the hour, another kind of epidemic. We'll explore how crystal meth has been ravaging small towns in the American heartland. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We continue our discussion today on HIV and AIDS around the world with looks at Southeast Asia, Central Asia, Brazil, and some other areas. We're joined now by Dr. Chris Beyrer. He is a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
We've already spoken about the Middle East, Europe, and Southern Africa. Let's talk a bit about Southeast Asia. What percentage of the population is HIV positive or living with AIDS in places like Thailand and Burma?
Well, Well, the epidemic in Southeast Asia has been very diverse. So you have some quite low prevalence countries with well under 1% or less of the population. Laos is in that category. Thailand, Burma, and Cambodia, three countries that actually are contiguous in the region, all had really together the most severe epidemic in the region. They peaked at least 2% of reproductive age adults. But those numbers have come down since. So this region has been heavily affected, had several million people with HIV, but it never reached and now clearly is very unlikely to reach the levels that we've seen, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, Thailand seems like an obvious place for this because of the red light district. Are sex workers in Bangkok and elsewhere particularly at risk for the virus? Are they being educated in safe sex methods, and are they being tested regularly for infection?
Well, absolutely. The Thai epidemic really got going in several at-risk populations. Gay men were affected early on, injection drug users as well, but then also women selling sex in the extensive commercial sex industry. It's important to point out that many people tend to think of this as something like Thai women and foreigners, but in fact, work that we and others did showed very clearly that the reason this became such an important part of the Thai epidemic was because of the high rates of use of commercial sex services by Thai men. It really has to be local use to generate an epidemic. And this was very much a kind of a normative behavior, especially for young unmarried men, something like a rite of passage coming of age for Thai men. And so there was an explosive epidemic driven by commercial sex work, and there were very high rates of infection in women and in clients, but particularly in women working in what were called direct brothels, places where sex was sold on the premises. The Thai government responded early on with a very aggressive program called the 100% Condom Campaign. And this didn't just target women or clients, but really targeted the venues themselves and insisted that condoms be available and that the government would close down those places that didn't make condom use mandatory. Used to see signs over these places that said no condom, no sex, no refund. And that had a tremendous impact on very swift control of HIV in this population.
2 years ago, Doctors Without Borders published a report critical of the military-led junta in Burma, which claimed that fewer than 20% of the people there have access to anti-HIV medications. Can you think of any other country that has a lower rate of access to medications?
Well, certainly in this region, Burma is the worst performer by far. And it's really just been a tragedy because the epidemic there got going around the same time as Thailand in the late 80s. Thailand, of course, has universal access to antiviral therapy now. Burma has just lagged and lagged. And
is it just because the colonels don't want to spend the money? They just spent $200,000 on HIV/AIDS that year. That's 2008. That's minuscule for a country that has a major problem.
I would characterize it as criminal, to be perfectly honest with you, particularly because remember that while the people of Burma are desperately poor, this is a junta with enormous reserves. Their reserves at the time that they were spending that incredibly small $200,000 a year for the entire National AIDS Program, their foreign reserves were estimated at over $5 billion. Most of that is in banks in Singapore. And this is a military government that has systematically divested in both the health and the education sectors. They could be doing much, much more. And unfortunately, what we see is that for the great majority of people with HIV in Burma, they're still living in the pre-heart era, and people die really untreated, the great majority.
And Cambodia simply because it borders on both Burma and Thailand, or has the political turmoil there also played a role?
Well, Cambodia's epidemic was started a little later than both Thailand and Burma's. It was, again, an epidemic that was very much associated with that country's sex industry, which was extensive, and again, largely driven by local men using commercial services. They didn't have much injection drug use. There is a substantial component of HIV in gay men. I should say that that's also a major part of Burma's epidemic. Very high rates, the most recent report of about a third of men who have sex with men in Burma being HIV positive, or 31% prevalence or so. So very, very high rates. But Cambodia's epidemic also came under fairly rapid control, relatively speaking. And again, they implemented the 100% condom campaign. They've done better with HIV treatment access as well. A lot of that is donor support. But nevertheless, they have been able to reach higher levels of treatment, certainly, than Burma.
What about Central Asia? Is HIV/AIDS emerging as a problem there?
Central Asia is an interesting situation and a very challenging one in HIV. This is one of the newest regions of HIV spread. The region, and we're talking about, of course, the countries of Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, all parts of the former Soviet Union, are very close. Many of them have extensive borders with Afghanistan, which is, of course, now by far the world's largest producer of illicit opiates and exporter of opium and heroin. So these are our frontline states that all have epidemics largely driven by heroin use and, of course, by injection drug use. They also, unfortunately, share the legacy of the old Soviet system that did not believe in and did not use substitution therapy like methadone, which has been shown to, of course, treat addiction, but also to be an effective tool in HIV prevention because it gets people off needles and syringes, and needle sharing is the principal driver. So it's been very hard to get drug treatment going in Central Asia. And at the same time, these countries, many, have been very reluctant to implement needle syringe exchange programs. And, of course, until last year, the U.S. was not really willing to fund needle and syringe exchange programs either. So it has been very challenging to implement the basics of prevention for drug users in these areas. And these are quite hot epidemics. They are, at this point, still very concentrated. More than 60% of all infections across the stands are in injectors. So that actually is, from a public health perspective, pretty optimistic because these are not hard epidemics to deal with if you can implement the basics of prevention for drug users.
Does that apply to Russia and Ukraine as well?
Russia and Ukraine also have concentrated epidemics, largely among injectors. They do have infections in men who have sex with men as well, about 6% HIV prevalence in gay men in Russia. The epidemic in Ukraine is the most advanced in that region, and if you consider Ukraine part of Europe, it's the most severe epidemic in Europe now. And that has spread largely because of a failure of early prevention out into the wider population. But it's still more than half of infections there are in drug users.
Just one more place that you've studied, Brazil.
Yeah, a country that I think is a very good model for the impact that tolerance and protection for human rights can have on vulnerable populations. Brazil had an early outbreak of HIV right around the same time as the U.S., in fact. And in 1990, amazingly enough, it had the same HIV prevalence, about 1% of adults, as South Africa. And there were a lot of predictions that it was going to go in the same direction because there was a lot of commercial sex, fair bit of injection drug use, mostly with cocaine, a large open gay population, and looked like the potential for really an explosive epidemic.
Also, isn't the Catholic Church, it's one of the most Catholic countries in the world, doesn't the Catholic Church kind of discourage condom use?
Well, at the time, there was a real struggle around those issues, but I have to say that the Brazilian government took a pragmatic, public health-based approach. One of their mottos was really engagement of people at risk. Their sex worker program was designed by sex workers. They very much engaged the gay community. And the result is that Brazil's HIV rate is less than half a percent now, so less than 1 in 200 people. And they really are an amazing success story. They, of course, were also the very first developing country to implement universal access to antiviral therapy. And so treatment levels are really remarkably high in Brazil. They've had a big influence on a number of other developing countries who've, you know, it's hard to make the case that everybody can do what the U.S. or Western Europe has done, but many countries could achieve what Brazil has achieved.
My great thanks to you, Dr. Chris Beyrer, Professor of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
If you've missed any of the past segments in our series on HIV/AIDS, you can find them on our show page at WNYC.org, as well as links to the series we did back in 1987. And I want to especially thank Stephen Valentino, who produced this incredible series, and also applaud Helen Borton, who had the foresight to produce the series we did over 20 years ago. Up next, we'll hear about how an already depressed town in Iowa is struggling with crystal meth. Nick Redding spent 4 years reporting there. He joins us with a report from the Heartland. You can also watch the Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan that are going on live. Just go to our homepage at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.